about this?
It's
about this.
You could have come right in between us. We could have had a few moments ago.
We could have had a threesome.
You know, that maybe I shouldn't say that, but we
can talk about it both.
All right, there we go. Good afternoon. I would like to call to order the meeting, today's meeting, of the House Committee on Rules for Monday, March 30th. Our chair is absent for a little while, and so we have a totally different agenda. And I'll be bringing several bills of my personal selection. So if you're here to testify, you can leave the room now. It's a joke, and we're very glad that you're here, and I'm going to open a public hearing right now on House Bill 3332. Erin, will you tell us a little about this bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3332 requires business entity that intends to make political expenditure to first obtain approval from shareholders or members by affirmative vote, a majority of members or shares entitled to vote. The measure would become operative January 1st, 2016. It does have an emergency clause on the measure. We have a no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact has not yet been issued, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to start with testimony from Representative Leininger, and I understand that your attorney is here with you. So if you want to defer to him, that's up to you, but the floor is yours.
Yes, sir, I guess I would.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Coast. Very pleased to be before you today to testify in support of House Bill 3332, which we call the Shareholders United Bill. This is a modest bill that addresses a complex and growing problem, the rising influence of large corporate political contributions on our democratic process. Current research details that nearly 9 in 10 Americans agree that there is way too much corporate money in politics, and actually 51% of those surveyed strongly agreed with that position. But according to the 2010 decision in Citizens United, corporations have the same rights as individuals to speech, and therefore to make campaign contributions. Corporations are people. But if that is true, then it's certainly also true that corporations are owned by people, and that those shareholders should have a greater say in how their money is spent. What this bill will do is require companies to include shareholders in their political contribution decisions. It says that businesses must supply their shareholders with a budget of the amount set aside for political contributions. It obligates businesses to report the campaigns they intend to contribute to, and lastly, it requires shareholders be notified when a contribution is made. Is Citizens United a problem in Oregon? I submit that when a candidate for governor receives nearly $100,000 from one corporation, there's a problem. When a corporation in Missouri spends nearly $6 million on an Oregon ballot measure, there is a problem. And when an out-of-state corporation spends over $3 million on advertising in a U.S. Senate race in Oregon, there is a problem. So yes, I believe we have a problem here in Oregon. Some might argue that this is a partisan bill, but I've received many emails over the past month from constituents of varying political persuasions, all urging me to rein in election spending. I would also say that the large contributions are worrisome no matter whom the recipient is. And in recent Oregon elections, Democrats often outspent Republicans, so no, this is not intended to be a partisan bill. Others will argue that all political donations and advertising are implicit in free speech, and that any limit on campaign spending is therefore undemocratic. To these people, I suggest that if one side of a debate is given 1 minute and the other an hour, we have not had a fair and open debate. In 2014, 73% of the money that the two major party candidates for governor raised came from just 6% of their donors. 73% from 6% of the donors. When out-of-state companies spend millions on campaign advertising, Oregon people, real Oregon people, get left behind. So I'm here today to propose a solution, a modest solution aimed at reclaiming our elections, strengthening our democracy, and shifting influence back into the hands of people in Oregon. It's important to understand what the bill will not do. My bill will not lower the limits of campaign contributions. It will not stop PACs from funding advertising and political campaigns. It will not limit the Citizens United understanding of free speech. All the bill will do is involve shareholders in those decisions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a good bill. It's a bill aimed at promoting equality, accountability, and overall fairness. It's a bill that states without equivocation that our democracy is one where individuals matter and where Oregonians have a stronger voice in our elections. I respectfully urge the committee to send this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And after my colleague speaks, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you so much, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative from Lake Oswego, representing Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. In the years since the 2010 decision in Citizens United, the voices of powerful interests have become even more powerful in our democratic process. A recent study by the Brennan Center from New York University shows that in Senate elections alone, outside spending has doubled from 2010 to 2014 to $486 million. And in some competitive races, the ratio of outside dollars to locally raised dollars is two-thirds of the money comes from outside dollars. Spending by super PACs, organizations whose campaign restrictions have been very much reduced, eliminated by the Citizens United decision, have reached $1 billion. And of that $1 billion, $600 million of it came from just 195 sources. So the voice of a very small number of entities and people is becoming even greater as we make decisions about how to move forward in our democracy. House Bill 3332 would require that an entity that intends to make any political expenditure first obtain approval from shareholders or members by an affirmative vote. It would provide the check on campaign spending that Justice Kennedy envisioned when he wrote the majority opinion in the decision Citizens United. There was a Washington Post article on this in 2014 in October that said the premise of the decision was that government can't block corporate political spending because a corporation is simply an association of citizens with free speech rights, and an association can be subject to the democratic workings of its members. A corporation making corporate decisions will be subject to the democratic workings of its members. Well, that can be true if we pass a law that requires that a corporation operate by the democratic workings of its members before it or an LLC or a cooperative make a political funding decision. And in that manner, we can instill in this Citizens United decision, which has really turned campaign funding on its head and opened up really new realities for how people make decisions in our country, we can align it with at least what Justice Kennedy thought he was doing, the check and balance system that he thought he was applying or would be built into the Citizens United decision. So for that reason, I join my colleague chief sponsor, Representative Gomberg, enthusiastically encouraging you to move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representatives. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I ask committee staff, the committee seems to be in possession of dash one amendments. Is that true or not? I have dash one amendments in my folder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I do not have dash one amendments to House Bill 3332.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rayfield. Yeah,
so I just had a quick question. On section two, subsection two, it says it was talking about unless basically a corporation cannot make a political expenditure unless the corporation's shareholders have voted the majority of shares of the corporation by an affirmative vote of all of the votes entitled to be cast. And so the way I was reading that was, and that's kind of repeated in various forms throughout, but the way I was reading is that voted by a majority of the shares in the corporation, so that tells me that there's 50% of all of the corporation's shares must vote to qualify to make an action, and then by an affirmative vote of that 50%. Is that a proper reading of that? It's a little bit goofy, but
I was trying to interpret it as best I could.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rayfield, yes, you're reading it from a lawyer's point of view, and I would submit to you that it was written by a lawyer, and your understanding is correct.
Lawyers should write these things better.
That's why you're so good at reading that. Representative Nose.
My question is more technical. So how would this sort of work in the state of Oregon? Like, you know, what would you envision the process would be for a corporation would solicit, you know, my recommendation on a vote? How would it work? Or an endorsement, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would refer again to the decision authored by Justice Kennedy. He says, with the advent of the Internet, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. So I think what he contemplated in authoring Citizens United is that we'd use the Internet to let people know what's going on and to get a quick, efficient, and prompt response.
Sure. So would it work kind of like how it works in my union, where, you know, a group of members come together, they interview candidates, they go through an endorsement process, they weigh the pros and cons of the various candidates that are, you know, up before us, and then a recommendation is made to the body, and then the body decides whether or not they're going to go with that?
My understanding is that at a member meeting or a shareholder meeting, there would be a vote on, I believe it calls for a budget, and some detail for the next year's expenditures. And so if a majority of the members eligible or shareholders eligible to vote supported it, then that would be an approval that would authorize the move to move forward.
Follow up.
So I own some stock, all right, and then, but I also have my retirement invested in a 401k that's invested in a variety of mutual funds and stocks. As a participant in a 401k plan, would I have the ability to vote on these kinds of things?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Nose, my understanding is that there are different kinds of institutional investors, and some of them may not make political contributions. This Washington Post article that describes the mechanism, which is being, this bill is being introduced in a few jurisdictions, including in Maryland. One of the interesting things is it says, let me quote, further, if no majority will of the shareholders can form to spend money for political candidates because most shares are owned by institutions forbidden to participate in partisan campaigns, then the corporation will be prohibited from using its resources on political campaigns. So it depends on the entity holding the resource, whether there would be a representative vote.
Okay, so one more follow-up. So in theory, you know, money that I have invested through my employer's 401k, I don't know off the top of my head if my 401k plan is permitted to make contributions. It sounds like maybe not. So that would be precluded, but any stock that I might own as an investment purpose outright, I'd be able to participate in this.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Nose, my understanding is that if you are a shareholder or a member in an LLC and you satisfy the voting requirements for that entity, then at a meeting of the entity, a regular periodic meeting, which they have, you would be called upon to vote on this as an item of business along with other kinds of items of business. So it would make it more routine, and it would enable the marketplace of ideas, the democratic process of an entity to happen, just as Justice Kennedy thought might help offset the burdens created by the Citizens United decision.
Representative Gilliam, you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad you returned. First of all, thank you both for bringing this, and you know I have a great deal of respect for both of you. I may not agree with this bill, but I certainly have an appreciation for your comments, particularly about bringing us closer to what the democracy should be. I don't know if the state of Oregon can have a huge effect on the larger question, but that's not a reason not to do something. What concerns me is the possibility around this bill for great partisanship because of the great divide that we experience in Oregon between, on the one extreme in campaigns, the corporate side, on the other extreme, unionized folks. So that concerns me about the bill. I guess my question that you don't have to either comment on or answer is just this. If, in fact, we set this bill aside this session, would you be interested in coming back with a concept that would address both those sort of extreme sides of the campaign rodeo in Oregon? That this one, by appearances to me, leaves out a whole side of campaign issues around funding. Is that something that you would entertain if we set this aside for a larger examination of problems, solutions in campaign funding in Oregon?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Interim Chair. Let me assure you, first of all, that our respect is mutual. If this is the beginning of a conversation, I think that's a good thing. I believe on its face it's a good bill. As I said earlier, I don't believe it's a partisan bill, and I would stress that this measure would not preclude corporations from making contributions in any amount. It simply says that when Representative Knows buys shares in a company, and that company chooses to make major contributions here in Oregon, that he would have some say about how his money is being spent. No limitations on how much of that money, only that he would have some say.
Chair Gilliam, I'm sorry, Chair Hoyle, Representative Gilliam. He used to be Chair Gilliam just moments ago.
Kind of a co-chair thing going on here.
I would note an important distinction that exists in my mind between the contributions of union members and the corporate contributions that our bill seeks to get at, and that is the contribution of union members. They've already earmarked, have been provided, their members' contributions provided for this purpose. The profits from corporations that might be divvied up in a significant political give to one group or another are earned because of the work perhaps of union members, and is not going to, for example, wages and benefits. Or from shareholders. I would be open to participating in a conversation to try to move toward a campaign funding system for all candidates in which the deafening voice of one special group, one really affluent group, does not drown out other important voices. But I would note a really startling fact in this Washington Post article about a shareholder solution to Citizens United. It's from October 2014. And it notes something that I think shows the magnitude of this issue and why our bill, which does not cure all problems of campaign financing, but would help get at one very significant problem, is something that should pass this session. It says, the preceding week before this article, a technological error by a governor's association inadvertently revealed the names of dozens of corporate members of the policy committee of the super PAC. And because it was a super PAC, it didn't otherwise have to disclose its donors. But the leak revealed that Aetna, Coca-Cola, ExxonMobil, Microsoft, Pfizer, United Health Group, and Walmart had each chipped in $250,000 as statesman-level shareholders, with other corporations participating as well. And there are some entities that have made their voices heard very loudly in the recent ballot measures that we've had in federal elections in Oregon and around the country. And I think that we need to start addressing the extent to which that deafening roar is drowning out the voices of regular people. And I think a great start would be for us to pass House Bill 3332 this session, and I also look forward to addressing other issues to make sure regular people's voices are the voices that drive elections.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, if I could add one thing to that, and I say this in all sincerity because I'm not here being critical of corporations that are participating in the process. I'm being critical of the process. If we were to draw a comparison to union activity versus corporate activity, what I would say to you, first of all, is that union member contributions to their political action committees are voluntary. The shareholders who are participating in corporate political contributions are not voluntary or necessarily informed. The second thing I would say to you is that that union members in most of our unions, I believe all of them, are involved in the endorsement process, the interview process, and in determining what kind of contributions will be allocated. Again, that is not the case with corporate contributions. So if anything, I would say that we are applying here, in this case, the suggestion that the same rules be applied to both of those players in the process. Again, I don't believe that corporations are doing anything wrong. I'm saying that there's a problem with the system, and I'm trying to provide more transparency in that system and more accountability to the shareholders.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that you said in your testimony makes clear to me a rationale for Citizens United that I had never understood. And that's probably because I haven't actually read the opinion, and I probably should have. The point you made was Justice Kennedy's observation that corporations are associations of people doing business together, and his expectation then that those people would be the ones that would control the corporation's behavior when it comes to political contributions. I think you've described quite well how that's how the actual what the actual effect is, because shareholders of large corporations with many, many shareholders in the United States at least have very, very little power. Even removing a markedly incompetent board of directors is extremely difficult to do by the shareholders. Your proposal, I think, sounds to me as though it's a direct response to Justice Kennedy's challenge, which is to put the shareholders in charge of the association or the corporation's political activity. One other observation, and then I'll be quiet. The reason why this case never made any sense to me, from a theoretical point of view at least, is that corporations, business corporations at least, have a set of interests which is much narrower than the interests of real people. They're formed for the purpose of making money. They may engage in a variety of different businesses, but the point of it is to pool the resources brought by the shareholders and make money. And that significantly limits their capacity to participate as real agents in a democracy by themselves. If, in fact, they represent their shareholders, who, after all, one hopes many of them at least are real people, that obviates at least a part of that difficulty. One should never expect a corporation to behave differently than its own financial interest, because after all, that's the only reason it exists, is to pursue its own, the financial interests of its shareholders and therefore of itself. So its ability to participate in as a citizen in the community is severely limited, because many individuals, of course, regularly do things in the community that are not in their personal self-interest at all, but which they believe are of interest to the community as a whole or of a particular segment of the community different from themselves. So I think your bill has merit. I expect that if it's brought to a vote, I'll support it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Interesting idea. One question that I might pose relates to shareholders themselves. And I know that when it comes to investing and talking about mutual funds and so forth, that there are sector funds that certain people choose to buy because they believe in that particular stock or that particular philosophy, and others they don't buy based on the same thing. And by the same token, I would think shareholders would have an opportunity to sell their shares and leave a company that is making contributions that they philosophically oppose. Do you see that as a possibility for folks to do?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, is it a possibility? I would say certainly. In the current environment, I would say that there's precious little information being shared with people in order to make the kind of decisions that you've just suggested.
Follow-up. Really more of a statement than anything else. That's really something I'd be interested in studying out, because I don't know what kinds of information would be promulgated along the line to the shareholders about what the corporations specifically do as far as their corporate donation policy. So that would be interesting to find out, and I'll check that out. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rayfield, did you have something?
Chair Hoyle, may I respond also?
Yes.
Representative Wilson, there one of the features I think stands in the way of what you're suggesting, but your suggestion is really important, is that super PACs, which don't have an obligation to disclose the sources of their funds, are one of the entities into which business entities often put money. And so this example I read about all the entities that had put $250,000 each into a fund, it was only through inadvertent technological error that information got out. So voting with your feet is a good idea when it's possible. And, you know, in Oregon, we have this ORSTAR system in which our campaign contributions are made public. I think the federal government has been trying to pass an analog to that under the Disclose Act that would have everyone make clear what their contributions are in some manner, but apparently they have not been able to get to a conclusion on that.
So following up on some of the shareholder stuff, not all shareholders are created equal. Some have voting rights, some don't. Some are in mutual funds, things like that. So I was curious, does this apply to shareholders that have voting rights, or does this apply to, you know, all shareholders would create voting rights? And then the second question I had was more along the lines. It looks to me that this applies to corporations that want to contribute to candidates or causes within Oregon. Or does this only apply to Oregon corporations? So sorry for the two questions.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Rayfield, my understanding in response to those two questions is that, one, it applies to corporations that want to make contributions in Oregon, and the other question was
about shareholders.
In my understanding, and we can get back to you with clarification if I get this wrong, is that it applies to voting members and the voting rights that they have. Okay. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, anybody else? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Okay, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3332 and open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 29. Erin, will you describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. HGR 29 proposes amendment to Oregon Constitution establishing an independent redistricting commission to adopt legislative and congressional redistricting plan following the 10-year census. It establishes compensation and eligibility for appointment to commission, establishes criteria for preparing legislative and congressional redistricting plans, permits counties to determine units of representation, which are composed of communities of interest, to be kept whole for the redistricting process, establishes a timeline for the redistricting process, requires public hearings in designated locations before and after proposed redistricting plans are created. Plans established by the commission are not subject to amendment, referral, or repeal by legislative assembly, but are subject to voter referendum, vests authority in Oregon Supreme Court to review plan, and refers proposed amendment to the people for their approval or rejection at the 2016 general election. We have no revenue impact. We have not yet received a fiscal impact on the measure.
Representative Bueller, and we will be joined by Representative Davis at some point, but his other bill is being heard. So,
laggard today.
Yes, he is.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of Bend. I'm here to speak in support of House Joint Resolution 29, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this important issue. It's something I felt passionate about for many years. And I think that Oregon's redistricting process is broken. It's creating a number of serious problems, but the top two are these. It's creating more and more partisan districts through this process. Partisan meaning that we're creating safer and safer districts, both on the Republican and on the Democratic side. And as a result of this, we're also creating less and less competitive elections. It's estimated now that out of the 75 House and Senate races that we have every 2 years, only about 10% are even competitive because of the way that we've redistricted these districts. And I think we really need to step up and move in the direction of both our neighbor to the north, Washington, or our neighbor to the south, California, who both have a form of independent redistricting. We need to be united on the West Coast with regards to a more modern approach to how we divvy up our election boundaries. And also join 13 out of 15 states now across the country who've moved in this direction. And right now we have a really unique opportunity because we're going to have another bite at this apple in 2022. And right now, we have no idea who's going to be the next Secretary of State, who in this state, historically, it moves into that person's fold to undertake this important duty. Now, we might say that we had a unique situation in 2011 where the legislature, for the first time in 100 years, was able to take care of this problem themselves and not go to the Secretary of State. So we anticipate, if it's consistent with the last 100 years of Oregon democracy, the Secretary of State will decide this issue in 2022. And I think it's also safe to say that we had a unique situation in 2011 where we had an equally split 30-30 House, which created a lot of incentives for that to happen. And it's just not myself who feels strongly about this issue. I think the Portland City Club has shown real leadership on this issue. They've studied it extensively, and I refer to their good work from their independent nonpartisan commission, which they outline this problem in immense detail. And the bottom line is they see a real conflict of interest with regards to legislators sitting around the table dividing up their districts in ways that I think are not very healthy for our democracy. So in summary, I very much encourage you to take a careful look at this House joint resolution, and it would simply refer to the people of Oregon a constitutional amendment to create an independent redistricting commission for the first time in Oregon. So thank you very much.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There seems to be a movement, I think through legal action, to challenge this kind of an approach to redistricting, at least of Congress, because the federal constitution requirement, as I recall, is that legislatures are supposed to do the districting. Do you have any thoughts about how this proposal would fare under that kind of constitutional analysis?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, excellent question, and there you are very much right. There is a pending U.S. Supreme Court case which could potentially throw out these independent redistricting commissions, and if it did, then this would be moot and it wouldn't be needed. But I think we should know that in the next few weeks, in my understanding.
Oh.
But you know how that goes with Supreme Court cases. Sometimes that's not always the case. But, yeah, it's very pertinent to this resolution, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a technical question. So does the commission actually draw up the districts, or does it do the legwork, so to speak, and make a recommendation to us, the legislature, and then we have to adopt whatever it does, like a yes or down vote?
Madam Chair, Representative Nosia makes a recommendation. So, yes.
Oh. If I could, Madam Chair, that sounds like it takes care of the issue I raised. If the legislature actually adopts a law, then this case that you and I were just discussing doesn't apply.
Yeah, and I'll, Madam,
Yes, Aaron, would you like to clarify that?
Madam Chair, Representative Nose, the Independent Redistricting Commission actually adopts the plan as proposed by Representative Bueller. The Legislative Assembly would not have a role.
Oh.
The people could still have a role via referendum of the plan of the Independent Redistricting Commission as envisioned in this measure.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Bueller.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, though if the rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court would adversely affect how this is currently written, we could amendment for that purpose.
Yep.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, we will keep this public hearing open for when Representative Davis comes down, but what I would like to do now is open up a word. I know I have other people testifying, but I am going to close HJR 29 and we'll come back to it and open up a work session on House Bill 2208. Aaron, will you describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2208 has been heard on March 2nd, and we heard it again on March 23rd. It's the measure that adds civil code enforcement officers to public officials who may request exemption from required disclosure under public records laws of specified personal information, and the measure defines civil code enforcement officer. On March 23rd, we adopted the -1 amendment. It removes the Department of Public Standards and Safety Standards and Training and other state agencies from entities exempt, and instead allows civil code enforcement officers to list their as a public employee who may request that any driver or vehicle record be kept by Oregon Department of Transportation containing or required to contain eligible employees' resident address, contain instead the address of the public agency employing the eligible employee. ODOT shall remove employee's resident address from its records, permits employee to substitute address of public agency employing that person on any driver or vehicle form issued by ODOT that requires an address to be on it. We have a no revenue impact on the -1. We have a minimal fiscal no statement was issued on the -1 amendment before you.
Okay. With that, we adopted the -1 amendments on March 23rd. I would accept a motion.
Madam Chair, I have a motion that I'd like to repeat.
Great.
From the other day. And I move House Bill 2208 to the floor with due pass as amended recommendation.
Is there discussion?
Madam Chair, I was for this bill last week and I'm for this bill this week. I appreciated some of the concerns that were raised. Part of it had to do with rural Oregon, and it was precisely rural Oregon that attracted me to this bill because of the danger of what do we call these workers again? Please remind me.
Code enforcement officers.
Their vulnerability in a small community to these kinds of inappropriate actions against them. And so based on the kinds of testimony that we heard on other bills protecting certain groups of public employees, this one made sense to me. And again, I want to add that simply by passing this bill for code enforcement folks, we do not completely, in any sense of that word, completely protect them. And I want to again urge us as legislators and as leaders in our communities to do what we can to minimize their vulnerability, whether it's Facebook or other kinds of vehicles that could put them at risk, and to remind them that this bill is well intended but does not solve all of their problems. And their personal responsibility and protection of information is important as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Hearing none, is there objection? Hearing none, the motion passes. We'll have Representative McEwen carry the bill and close the work session. With that, I'm going to reopen HJR 29 and call up Bruce Miller.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior counsel to the State Court Administrator. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department, which includes the Circuit Courts, the Tax Court, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court. We thought it might be worthwhile to share some of the issues that we've spotted in this measure with you for your consideration as you go forward with it. I'd like to frame my discussion with a couple of questions, and then I'll go into some detail. Question one, what happens to the redistricting process if there aren't enough retired judges to fill the required pool of 18? Related to that is, what happens to the redistricting process if there aren't enough judges in the pool of 18 who are registered with the top two vote-getting parties? And then an unrelated question, who has standing to challenge a redistricting plan in the Supreme Court? So I'll start with the pools. The preference in the measure is for a pool from the retired appellate court judges. It is highly improbable that there will ever be enough retired appellate judges to fill the pool of 18. We currently have 11 Plan B and senior retired judges from the appellate courts. At least three of those would not qualify to sit on the commission under the terms of this measure. Four of them are in their 80s. You can see the pool gets very small. It's a little, if we're unable to fill the pool from the appellate court judges, then we start to look at the retired circuit court judges. At first blush, the numbers are rosier in that area, but you'll see that the numbers quickly dwindle down as we consider how this will work. And by the way, anecdotally, we probably have around 35 judges who would not be able to serve due to age and health issues that we think right now. I suspect that number is higher than that because we don't always know what's going on with our retired judges. So right now there are basically two categories of retired judges that you look at. There are Plan B judges who continue to serve the state in exchange for a modest increase in their PERS benefit. They're required to serve a minimum of 35 days a year for 5 years. Right now we have about 46 of those judges. It seems unlikely that many of those judges will want to volunteer for this service. They are retired and they already are donating a significant amount of time to the state. So that may affect how many of those judges you actually see. There are also some possible conflicts here with the single office provision in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 1, and with PERS retirement rules that may make this difficult to employ these judges. That takes us to the senior judges. We have approximately 54 of those available right now. This tends to be an older group of judges than the Plan B judges for obvious reasons. They've served their Plan B service and they've moved on from there. The commission's work is going to be difficult and it's going to involve a significant amount of travel. And so we are concerned that it may be difficult to recruit some of these older judges to take on this task. And they still have to meet the requirements of the bill, just like all the other judges. They can't have held partisan office. We've had judges who have served in the assembly as well as other partisan offices. They can't have been paid to lobby, which raises an issue. Does that include the Chief Justice and other judges who lobby the assembly on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department? They're certainly being paid and they're lobbying. That would take another significant chunk out of your pool. And going back to the Plan B, I'll move on for there. We don't need to go there. But the other issue that we have is one of the conditions in the measure is that they can't have retired for chronic physical or mental disability. Judges don't have to tell us why they retire. We don't always know why they've retired. We may not know that they have these issues. And so it might be worthwhile to think about more objective criteria for determining that, such as retired on a medical disability or retired subject to fitness investigation or proceeding. Many of our judges are not residents of this state. After they retire, they move on, Arizona and places like that. You may want to consider whether there should be a residency requirement in the measure. Once the pool of 18 is established, the problems don't go away because the measure requires that there be a smaller pool consisting of judges registered with the party that received the most votes and another small pool from the party that received the second most votes. As I'm sure many of you know, a lot of our judges are not affiliated with a political party, and that runs the risk of having a pool of 18 and not having anyone that can fill these smaller pools. Another thing to consider is putting or specifying in the measure who determines who received the most votes and who received the second most votes. It seems obvious that that's a chore for the Secretary of the State. That's in their wheelhouse, but the measure doesn't speak to that. The measure does consider that a commissioner may have to step down because they're no longer able to serve and requires that position to be filled from the pool, but there is no requirement or specificity on replenishing the pool. And so as you have people step down for a variety of reasons, you'll want to think about having a way to replenish that pool. And the other thing to think about when a new commissioner comes in is, does that restart the redistricting process or do you just continue where you're at on it? So it's worthwhile to think about some safety valves for these issues. What happens if there's an inadequate pool at either level? What happens if the commissioners don't come to agreement on a final plan? What happens if the commissioners don't make the deadline for the final plan? Now, on to the commission process. The measure requires Secretary of State to provide data. It might be worthwhile to put more clarity in there that it also involves specialized computer platforms, specialized software, and other technical assistance, as Ms. Seiler knows. There is a lot that goes in, and that's the heart and soul of redistricting, is that sort of information. Final plans, the commission must submit their final plans to the Secretary of State 180 days before the primary. The primary date is set in statute. The Assembly can change that date. It might be worthwhile to instead designate a dirt date certain rather than tying it to that date, which may change. Mm-hmm. It may be helpful to specify, there are a number of areas in the measure that talk about things that need to occur, but they don't say who has to do them. So, it would be worthwhile to clarify who has responsibility for providing and paying for office space, equipment, software, phone lines, internet, ADA accommodations, service and supplies. Who has to post the commission records and data, who maintains the software and the internet connections for the public access terminals. There's a lot of detail that's left up in the air here that could help. Another thing that would give us some comfort and keep this out of the political muddle is if there were a provision that required the Assembly to make an appropriation to cover the costs of the commission. Regarding judicial review, there is no trigger for the 30-day period within which to file a petition. So you can anticipate there will be disputes whether a petition to the Supreme Court was filed in a timely manner. There's no limitation that the challenges to the Supreme Court are only to the final plans, which could lead to premature challenges on the draft plans that the commission must prepare. There's no standing requirement in the measure, which may allow challenges by out-of-state persons and entities. The current Constitution gives standing to an elector of the state, just if you want some wording to look for. There are some general drafting issues. There are a number of terms in the measure that could benefit from definitions, such as measure of competitiveness. There's some cleanup that's needed. There's a provision that says Office of the State Court Administrator shall provide the Administrative Office of the Courts with the names of all former judges, which, as near as I can tell, means the State Court Administrator must give herself a list of the judges. If you take anything away from what I've had to say this afternoon, I hope it's that thinking about safety valves is an important part of this process. Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Miller. Have you had an opportunity to share these criticisms with either or both Representatives Bueller and Davis? I know we're on record here, but sometimes communication is not that free.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I've not had an opportunity. It's been kind of a busy session.
I hope that you do. And a quick follow-up, Madam Chair, I'm wondering how you would feel, given your probably valid criticism of the pool that we have to choose from, what about individuals who may have played a judge on television or in a commercial?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think that is really an interesting idea for the Assembly to explore.
Okay, just saying that.
Thanks for the clarification.
Yes.
Vice Chair Gilliam. Does anyone have questions?
Better not.
Representative Wilson?
Madam Chair, I don't have any questions. I just continue to go back to think about the agony of redistricting when I was chair of that committee in 2001. Always interested in hearing an alternative.
Any other comments, questions? No, thank you very much.
You.
And I would agree with my vice chair that reaching out to Representatives Bueller and Davis to share your concerns, which I think are very, very valid. I appreciate you bringing them forward and think it'd be important for you to share with them so that they can put that information to work in the next iteration of whatever this bill is amended into being.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to do so.
And with that, I am going to close the public hearing on HJR 29 and close the work. What are we doing?
Adjourn.
We're going to adjourn. We're just going to adjourn.
Are we meeting Wednesday?
Yes.
Are we meeting Wednesday?
Yes, adjourn.